This week on the Emerging Cricket Podcast, a farewell to former Papua New Guinea captain Kaya Arua as PNG's women travel and win overseas. The Women's T20 World Cup qualifier coming up, Namibia in Oman and the rankings nonsense, Island Wolves in Nepal, Nepal also in India as part of the Friendship Cup, Canada in the USA, and a whole lot more. Stick around. Wherever you are listening to us, welcome in again. Hello. Thank you for joining us. Daniel Beswick alongside Nick Skinner for the week. Tim, in preparation for the Women's T20 World Cup qualifier with Vanuatu, is missing. It will be in Australia briefly, so hopefully we'll catch up with him en route to UAE. But Nick, speaking to you, last week we discussed the Icelandic word, what was it, Glitkavit, which was window weather, cold outside, but beautiful.
Glitkavitur.
Well, we're starting to get at that now in Sydney. I was doing my grocery shop the other day and found myself a little bit cold and wishing I was inside, but the sky was blue. Mm. How's things over there in Iceland?
Yeah, busy time. A lot of travel to organize over the summer, trying to see a lot of places, a lot of things, a lot of people. But, you know, got to keep plugging along. Tons of cricket going on as well to keep up with. So busy time here for us and a busy time on the show.
There is cricket everywhere. Just looking at our document today, PNG in Zimbabwe, alongside some sad news that we'll talk about as well. The T20 World Cup qualifier, as you mentioned, coming up in UAE. Namibia in Oman. Island Wolves are in Nepal. Nepal also travelled to India to visit Baroda and Gujarat. Canada v USA with the not so sure if this is the Audi Cup or not, but they're playing against each other on the road to the T20 World Cup. Action aplenty. Nick, how have you done keeping up with it all?
Yeah, I mean, finally was able to. I was able to watch the T20 against Canada, so it's nice to see them back on. Well, on computer screen, decent broadcast quality actually by associate cricket standards. And yeah, a lot of these series are quite interesting. You know, in the light of the T20 World Cup and the qualifiers on the women's side. You know, PNG and Zimbabwe prepping there, and Canada and USA in the same World Cup group, and Namibia and Oman in the same World Cup group. So yeah, kind of like a lot of series here that are sort of half an eye on the future. So that's always fun to speculate how the team's going to go in their next assignment.
We'll get into everything going on and some news that came through late, just as we released last week. So we were able to at least announce the news via the podcast, even though it'd been out and around, published on EC and news swept through the cricketing world. But a somber start, I suppose, to talk about the kind of emerging cricket week, and that was the death of Kaya Arua of Papua New Guinea, just 33 years of age in Papua New Guinea. She was PNG's leading T20I wicket taker on the women's side, had the second best bowling figures in a T20I, 5-wicket haul against Japan. Came into the Papua New Guinea team in 2010, played through the pathway events on the EAP side as well as the Pacific Games, claimed a silver medal at the Pacific Games at one point, was given the captaincy on an interim basis in the late 2010s before being given it on a permanent basis soon after, was part of the ICC's global development squad in the late 2010s as well. And was captain of the side into the early 2020s and then bowed out as captain after that Pacific qualifier at the T20 World Cup qualifier for the East Asia Pacific region last year. Also played in the recent Pacific Cup as well. And this news definitely took us, sent us backward and put us on the floor. I think just, you know, talking to everyone around the EAP region, there was the news kind of crept through in the early afternoon on that particular day and didn't quite believe it when, you know, it was first sort of being thrown around. And then the news from Cricket Papua New Guinea came a little bit later in the afternoon. Hugely sad news. The left arm wrist spinner, a joy to watch play, both batting and bowling. Such a languid left arm wrist spin action, just flowed through the crease I don't like the term naturally gifted when it comes to cricket and sport in general, but it just seems so natural and languid. Her bowling action through the crease, it was so fun to watch. As captain of the team, she was, and even, talking in interviews, she was quiet and she just took a couple of moments to kind of collect herself before she sort of spoke, being interviewed and in front of the press and stuff like that. I got the impression in her captaincy as well, she thought a lot, and she, I think her idea of life was, I've got two ears and one mouth, therefore I'm going to listen twice as much as I speak. She was quiet in the way she went about things, but she was a smart operator and a great captain for PNG in her time. And yeah, the news was a bit of a shock to all of us here in the AAP region, and we send our thoughts to, people involved in cricket PNG and the family of Arua. We know that in PNG it's a very tight-knit group. I believe the Oviers involved in cricket PNG are deeply connected to the Arua as well in terms of family ties. But yeah, it's incredibly sad news, and one we didn't really see coming, I'm afraid.
No, I mean, it's 33-year-old. She's been in the team, played her first senior match for PNG back in 2010. So she's been a key part of the team for over a decade now. And I mean, she played as recently as early this year in the Pacific Cup, as you mentioned. So it's shocking to just get the news that she's gone. And yeah, a great servant of cricket in PNG, just a lover of the game and a pretty thoughtful character. It's a big loss for PNG, I would say, both on and off the field, in terms of how much she does or did for the game there. And I mean, yeah, also played in the Fairbreak. She's just a sort of an institution of the women's associate game. PNG hasn't published any more details about what happened, out of respect for the family. But this isn't the first time a PNG player has died quite young, and it's really unfortunate that this kind of thing, I guess, seems to happen in PNG. And yeah, just so sad because she's was a great player for PNG, and way too soon. This is before anyone should have to depart the world. But I guess we'll just remember her for her great performances for PNG, and carrying the team with the bowling lineup for 14 years or so. And rest in peace.
Yeah, she shouldered the responsibility of Papua New Guinea as a captain. And I remember talking to her at the end of the Pacific qualifier, where I think they won the last match, but had been eliminated thanks to, Vanuatu winning in the concurrent game next door, meaning that they topped the group. And, it's already one of those bittersweet moments when you're interviewing someone and they've won the game, but they've not reached their goal of, in this case, qualification. And the sadness that came over her and the sorrow that she kind of felt at that moment, it was striking. And, it's one of those situations where, you just want to, give them a hug and say everything's okay. And yeah, it's incredibly sad. She was a character in several, Fairbreak competitions as well. She was part of the Falcons team across multiple seasons, and we know how important that competition has been in the growth of women's cricket. And just, I think, galvanizing everyone, having everyone in together in the one place, and really building from each other and with each other, what Fairbreak was. And Arua was certainly a key figure in all that. And the sad images we've seen this week have been from Zimbabwe, when the PNG girls have just, been touring, and they had a Kaya Arua jersey in their kit bag, obviously, because they knew that something was up, before they travelled. And to see them all, arm in arm, with tears in their eyes, commemorating their teammate and their friend, it struck pretty close to home. And yeah, just thoughts to everyone in the cricket PNG community, who have to, move forward after all of this as well.
Yeah, as you say, just tragic, and our condolences to PNG cricket and her family and all the players there. It sort of feels, I don't know, a bit meaningless to be talking about a bilateral cricket series, in the light of that. But in that ODI series against Zimbabwe, Zimbabwe won 3-0, and 2-1 in the T20I series, a tie as well in the T20I series that PNG won in the Super Over. It all happened before Arua's death, although, as you referred to, I think maybe they knew something bad was on the way. I don't know if she was, maybe she was sick or you know, something along those lines. But yeah, I mean, PNG's first women's ODI cricket, a little bit outclassed, although the second ODI, Vicky Arar, bowled very well and got Zimbabwe 8 down, chasing a pretty small target. It sort of looks like PNG in the 50 over format, you know, they don't play much in that format, especially in women's cricket, but even in men's cricket. So, you know, I think they were a bit found out in the longer format. But yeah, you know, pretty competitive nonetheless. Head over to Bertus de Jong's Twitter account for some discussion of how the rankings stuff is going to be affected with, you know, PNG getting on the board in terms of rankings and then going to be playing some ODIs soonish. And yeah, then the T20I series, Zimbabwe won the first and third matches pretty comfortably, and PNG got over the line in the super over there to in the second. But yeah, it's I guess the ODI series kind of shows just a gap in experience between PNG and Zimbabwe, who, I mean, Zimbabwe aren't playing a ton of 50 over cricket, but they do have a, you know, domestic women's 50 over comp, and they do play ODIs sort of here and there. So even that seems to have made a difference in terms of experience against PNG.
Yeah, don't want to harp on too much about the ODIs because, you know, this is valuable experience, and you'd like to think that there's a lot of lessons that come out of this for Papua New Guinea on the 50 over front. Sabona Jimmy is solidifying herself as one of the best associate all-rounders, and definitely, you know, pound for pound in East Asia Pacific cricket is one of the best, you know, women's cricketers on the circuit. I'm sure a couple of the Ni Vanuatu women would probably lay claim to that as well, but she actually came through and helped win the super over and the T20I series as well, but led the runs and claimed a handful of wickets in the ODIs. But moving to the T20s, while Zimbabwe did eventually claim the series 2-1, PNG were able to equalise through the second match that went to a super over. They actually did pretty well to salvage the match at the dying embers in the second innings in their chase. I think they needed 15 off the last over and they got 14. Thanks to some late hitting at the end. Paku Siaka made 43 off 33 balls and then was there with Sabona Jimmy, I think, in the super over as well. Paku Siaka and Sabona Jimmy ended up making 7 in the super over, and then Jimmy actually turned around and bowled the super over and kept Musonda and Kelison Lovu to just 6, a dot ball as well, to win that game as well. So that's a big moment for Papua New Guinea. It's their first women's T20I win over a full member opposition, which, I mean, whether or not you call it a victory, given it was a super over, where they're counting it as a victory on our end. But yeah, looking to this, you know, not only playing a full member opposition, and we do know that Zimbabwe have had their troubles and they're in a unique spot in the context of African women's cricket because the associates get a lot of cricket against each other and the pathway events almost seem to help them in spite of Zimbabwe, who as full members actually skip a lot of that cricket, and it's probably to their detriment. It's a point that we bring up a lot, but looking to PNG, one, it's tough to go away from home into Africa and to play a full member opposition, but to go there and win a match, take a match over a team like Zimbabwe, that's definitely a positive that they can take, you know, moving forward in future tours. We know that they're not going to be at the T20 World Cup qualifier because Vanuatu have taken that spot. But, you know, this is a good result for not only PNG cricket, but cricket in the East Asia Pacific region as well, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, it's always nice to see an associate beat a full member, even in a super over, we'll take it. As a side note, I do think it doesn't really make sense for non-knockout matches to always be super overs, but I guess that's a different question. It's encouraging that PNG are finding, you know, players who'll step up and perform. A few different names here, as you say, Paku Siaka was pretty good in the series. Tanya Ruma hit a half century as well. Brenda Tau hit 70 odd in the first match, the ODIs, that is. So, you know, they've got a few different players stepping up, which is good because, you know, a lot of the time teams kind of at PNG's level in the associate world, they'll have, you know, one or two match winners, but then the rest of the team are really struggling. And if you can start to piece together more of the, you know, sort of four or five, you know, solid core of players who will perform regularly, then you can kind of build around them. So that's encouraging that they've had a few different players step up in this series. And then, I mean, yeah, same on the Zimbabwean side. And this is, you know, you look at who's been performing for Zimbabwe, you know, Chipo Mugeri-Tiropano, Modesta Mupachikwa, Marianne Musonda. So some familiar names in terms of the batting there for them. And, you know, the bowling, Josephine Nkomo. Kelson Lovu had a pretty quiet series, actually, which is interesting. But yeah, so kind of, you know, the regular names for Zimbabwe, which goes to show, and this is visible at regional African level as well when they do play, they just have enough match winners that they can kind of carry themselves over the line. And that's probably the difference between a, you know, I guess a low-ranked full member and a high-ish ranked associate. So it's interesting to see how PNG kind of go from here. And I mean, obviously, probably playing cricket is the last thing on their mind at the moment. So that's tough for them, but good signs from their on-field performances, and hopefully it's something they can build on.
Yeah, we won't see Papua New Guinea at the Women's T20 World Cup qualifier because, as we mentioned, Vanuatu took that spot via East Asia Pacific. Zimbabwe will be there, where Zimbabwe will take on Vanuatu in that group as well. So maybe there is, I suppose, some motivation or some inspiration for Vanuatu there, knowing that a team that they beat on the road to this qualifier has also beaten Zimbabwe. We know it's going to be tough for a team like Vanuatu coming in into this qualifier against Ireland, the Netherlands, UAE, as well as the Zimbabweans in what is a brutal Group B. Looking at Group A, Scotland, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Uganda, and the USA. To quickly touch on the T20 World Cup qualifier, it begins in a couple of weeks' time at the time of recording, 25th of April. A quick look at this T20 World Cup qualifier. I know we'll probably talk about it a little bit more as it approaches closer, Nick, but Group B is a brutal one for Vanuatu to be put in. But looking at Group A, having Sri Lanka in that group, who you would think are probably morals to qualify for the T20 World Cup, the way that they're playing against full member opposition, and then Scotland and Thailand battling it out with Uganda and the USA. I think we're starting to see a little bit more parity on the women's side of things at this level. I think in times gone by at the qualifier, there's been a pretty big gulf in class between, say, the best team and the worst team. And, you know, while we look at a team like Sri Lanka and say that, you know, they're probably that close to their best, you know, the fact that they're even here is going to be a huge challenge for everyone involved. The USA are comfortably, you know, the youngest team in that group, and they might find it tricky first up, but you would think that this is a good tournament for them in future iterations and future cycles. Just a question without notice to you, Nick, just looking at these groups, do you also have the impression that, you know, the quality amongst, you know, between the best and the worst teams at this level is getting a little bit closer?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a lot of these teams play each other a little bit more, which so I think definitely one to keep an eye on is that quad series with the US, Scotland, UAE and Netherlands, and kind of see where they're all going as sort of a gauge, because you think of Scotland as being, you know, one of the leading associates, but then, you know, where's the USA in all this? Their team is very young on the women's side. It's they're picking a lot of youth, which is great. They're giving opportunities. It's a very interesting team in terms of how much cricket, you know, the women's domestic pathway has been producing. I mean, it's a lot more domestic cricket for women than they've had in the past, so they've kind of been able to get a bit more of an idea of who their best 11 is, which, I mean, the men's side of things is a bit more murky, but the USA women's, for what they've been able to achieve with very limited resources and, you know, limited playing pool, has been impressive. So I think it'll be interesting to see how they go coming up against stronger associate opposition. You would imagine Sri Lanka, you know, looking at that group and how Sri Lanka are going at the moment, Sri Lanka are raging favourites. You know, other than that, it's very open. You know, Thailand, you know, traditionally you would kind of think of the sort of second team there, but they've been struggling a bit of late. And yeah, Uganda, another exciting team coming out of Africa. They often, their batting is kind of a question mark, but their bowling is going to be a challenge for any of these teams. So yeah, I mean, yeah, you'd think it's kind of a race to second place with Sri Lanka sewing up first place in that group. But yeah, Group B, very open. I mean, you you'd kind of see Vanuatu as the weak link in that group, much as it pains me to say it, because you know, all of those other teams have performed at various occasions and have looked pretty good. So it will be interesting to see that quad series to get maybe a bit more of a gauge of the quality. And yeah, the ranking stuff, and I mean, Women's League too, obviously that would be fantastic. Or even they could expand the Women's Championship as it sort of currently stands. But yeah, that's another question. I guess the only thing I would say on Women's League 2 is hopefully there's some kind of proper play-in qualifications for it. Because as things stand, if they just go with the teams that have ODI status, yeah, that leaves out a few better teams like the UAE, who for some bizarre reason don't have Women's ODI status, despite, I would argue, being a much better team, well, than the USA and also than PNG on the women's front. So yeah, kind of a strange situation with that ranking stuff, but you know, that's one for the future. Yeah, I mean, who comes out of these groups? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, especially because Group B, the two full members in that group, Ireland and Zimbabwe, are not as far ahead of associates as I would say Sri Lanka probably are in their group. So yeah, Group B, a lot more open, but Sri Lanka, I mean, they've got to be nailed on, surely.
Yeah, it's not just the Chamari Adipadu show anymore for Sri Lanka as well, although she does play such a huge role still. But, you know, the Harshita Samarawickramas of the world, Inoka Ranawira as well, just two players just to kind of roll off the tongue there. And they're a side with a little bit more depth now. And Ireland, you know, were a team that knocked off Australia in a warm-up before the T20 World Cup last year as well. So there is history there, and they are two strong teams. It might be worth a discussion point down the line of potentially expanding the Women's T20 World Cup with more teams, knowing that, you know, Ireland and Sri Lanka are so strong. But there are a few teams sort of waiting in the wings and looking to knock them over. So looking forward to that tournament. As we said, it begins on the 25th of April. Let's look elsewhere in the Middle East, and Namibia have travelled to Oman in a five-match T20I series that plenty of discussion points here, and probably even before we even get to the field, talks of automatic qualification for future T20 World Cups and Namibia potentially shooting themselves in the foot here by playing a team below them on the T20I rankings and then losing two matches. We think now, or, you know, talking to Bertus de Jong about this, it looks as if it's going to take something monumental for them to grab an automatic qualifying spot through the automatic places to the next T20 World Cup. It would mean that if they don't take a Super 8 spot in the USA and the West Indies, they'd have to go through regional qualifying again, which is going to be brutal in Africa because, as we saw, Zimbabwe on the men's side miss out of T20 World Cup qualification thanks to Uganda and Namibia going through. So a little bit to talk about there that might not sort of come to be a particularly big point until after this T20 World Cup. So I suppose we could talk about the rankings fiasco in a second, Nick, but just to look at the result on the field, Namibia winning the decider by 62 runs, thanks to a Gerard Erasmus masterclass, runs with the bat, then took two wickets with the ball. It's been an inside joke at Emerging Cricket that his filthy off-breaks were described by him as filthy, and they're not so filthy anymore. Well and truly a three-dimensional player, one of the best fielders in the Emerging game, one of the best batters in the Emerging game, and now developing his off-spin as a nice complement to the likes of Bernard Skultz and other spinners in the team who spin the ball in the opposite direction. Not only that, he can keep as well, as we've seen in ILT20 stuff, yeah, as well, which was fun to see. But he was, again, the shining light. They had David Visa back for this series in the lead-up to the T20 World Cup. We know that he's been a maverick around the T20 circuit, and that's how he's built his cricketing career, and you can't fault him for making the most of that while he is still fit and able to, and he's got a nice relationship with the team at Cricket Namibia in doing all of that. But again, sort of a rotated squad. We know JJ Smith celebrated his honeymoon in Mauritius, and other players were away and unavailable or rested, you know, Jan Nicole Lofty eating, fighting fires and all sorts of things. So look, it's a good result for Namibia, this winning the series. I suppose we'll talk about the rankings fiasco in a moment, but I suppose job done from a prep side of things. These two teams actually meet in the group stage of the T20 World Cup too, which is a little bit odd, but First, a look to Namibia, winners of the series, and just doing enough while blooding a few extra plays here on the senior side.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I would say both teams probably got what they wanted out of this. The other than the ranking stuff, the final scoreline is a bit irrelevant. It was more just a hit out kind of experiment with a few players. I think Namibia, you would think they're getting closer to their best 11. You know, obviously David Visa coming in down the order is certainly strengthening their batting and bowling, because he's so flexible on both of those. Gerard Erasmus finding some form. JP Kotze finding some form as well. That was good to see. He's recently back in the team, gives them another option at the top of the order. Nico Davin. Milan Kruger was a bit disappointing. He was good in that last game where they put up 200. He hit, I think it was four or five sixes on his way to 40 odd off not many deliveries, but other than that, didn't do a whole lot. So I don't know, maybe he's going as a reserve keeper, or, I mean, where does Michael Van Lingen fit into that? You know, you'd think he's in with a shot. Maybe Van Lingen, they're thinking, is more of a 50-over player. I don't know. There's kind of still some questions around who's taking that opening slot, because, I mean, if JP Kotze is back in form, you know, we saw towards the end of, like, before he retired and sort of after he's come back, he does just have this little tendency to kind of struggle if he can't get the big shot away. So, you know, if he's worked on that and he's able to maybe rotate the strike a bit better when he's not hitting the ball out of the park, that'll make a big difference to his ability to contribute for Namibia. But yeah, I mean, overall, pretty good effort. I think the bowling, yeah, Jack Brassel and Dylan Leiker with the ball, you would imagine they're not in their best 11. You know, Brassel, I think he only bowled once. He didn't do a whole lot, and he didn't really bat either. So yeah, I guess I think they're kind of bringing him along for more for experience than anything else. But there's a lot of these guys who've sort of come in from the under-19s team, and I think they're all just a little bit raw, but, you know, playing this series and giving them a bit of experience is definitely good, and they're definitely ones you want to see coming through in the future. But yeah, on the bowling side, obviously Lungomeni quality. Ruben Trompelman seems to be gradually recovering from his injury. He was quite expensive in this series, but he did pick up a couple of wickets here and there, so hopefully he's kind of finding his rhythm. Scholtz was very impressive, you know, in that that last game where Oman had a big chase and they went hard. He still bowled at sort of under six and over. So, you know, his value, well, I mean, as a wicket taking option, but also just as, you know, one of the guys who'll be able to sort of keep a lid on scoring. He can bowl in the power play, and he can bowl, you know, sort of keep things tight throughout the middle. So, yeah, Scholtz once again showing his value to the team. Yeah, I guess you'd kind of imagine with Jana Cole Lofty-Eaton coming back into the team at some point, and JJ Smith as well in that middle order, they'll have a couple more bowling options. Smith especially, you know, another seam option. Shikongo, I think maybe played one game, didn't do a whole lot in this series. I'm not sure where he's fitting into their plans. But yeah, one question mark I would say is Jan Freilich. He bowled one over. He was playing more or less as a specialist bat, which, again, I really am not sure that they... It seems like a bit too cute, in my opinion, to have Freilich playing as a specialist bat if you're going to have Visa and JJ Smith as well in your middle order. You know, I don't see that Freilich adds enough with the bat to be playing in that role if he's not going to be bowling much. So yeah, I think that's probably the biggest concern for me with Namibia's batting lineup, is if they're not using Freilich as a bowler and they're trying to put him in the top four somewhere, then that's taking a place away from someone who's going to contribute more, in my opinion.
Yeah, maybe it's just a workload thing from Jan Freilich's side of things. We know that, you know, he and JJ Smith as well was sometimes has come in and played as a specialist bat that bowls a little bit when they need. I think they've even tried throwing the ball to JJ as a left arm orthodox spinner as well. You make a great point. JP Kotze, he could be the X factor that Namibia need at this T20 World Cup. We've lamented, I think, over the last two T20 World Cup campaigns that they've just lacked a little bit of power and aggression and upping the run rate in the power play overs. They don't really seem to make the most of those power play overs. We know that they've tried a few different combinations and they've had a little bit of success, but their run rate has normally been upped in the middle overs when Erasmus comes in with the likes of Visa and JJ Smith a little bit further down. So if JP Kotze can go as hard as we think he can and find the form that we saw him in maybe, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when he was a full-time member of this team, we know, you know, there's been some some family things and other things in his, you know, life that it's meant he hasn't really been able to kind of concentrate on cricket, you know, 5 days a week, you know, throughout the year. But if he finds that sort of form that we saw him, remember when he pongoed Hong Kong around at that World Cricket League 2 tournament in 2019, that was a sight to
Up
behold.
the
He,
USA for a ton in the League Two as well.
yeah, that's right. Yeah, not long after that. So if he can find that form, we know when he gets going, he can be a real asset to this team, who are, you know, looking for, you know, a power play specialist, because yeah, they have been a little bit too slow in the global tournaments. And yeah, just slowly building their depth. You know, Namibian cricket has been built, I think, you know, the culmination of the last 4 or 5 years is starting to come through now in terms of the guys on the fringe who are starting to make their way into the team. You know, for a long time it was basically their top 12 players or bust, and now you'd like to think it's probably 15 or 16. Jack Brassel got a lot of life in some of those wickets in that under 19 World Cup. It'll take a little bit of time for him to adjust and find his way in the senior ranks, but has got the makings of a good cricketer. Looking to see a little bit more out of Gerard Janse van Rensburg as well, who was the under-19 captain. Hasn't quite brought that form over into the senior ranks as well. Had a pretty quiet World Cup, albeit on some tough wickets to bat on as well. So looking forward to a bit more of their development. And it's meant that, you know, that development and blooding the youngsters has been at the sacrifice of their T20i ranking. And I suppose we'll talk about that maybe now before we get to Oman, because this does affect Namibia. And it's, I suppose, the gamble that you take if you're the Namibian setup. You know, you want to try and give kids a go, make sure you find that perfect squad for the T20 World Cup. But by losing two matches against a team below you on the rankings, you've essentially just potentially given Zimbabwe potential at claiming a free spot. You know, whether Zimbabwe get that automatic spot, that might help, you know, the continent of Africa going forward. Or if Namibia were to able, you know, to grab a Super 8 spot too, that might, you know, sort of negate the danger as well. But they're playing some, you know, they're playing with fire here, Namibia, in doing this and playing in this tour, because we want teams to play. And I think ultimately it's a positive that teams are playing, but sometimes you almost get punished for playing in these series when you play teams below you on the rankings. We saw it at the African Games as well, you know, dropping points to teams below. How much does this potentially hurt Namibia looking forward after this T20 World Cup? Sure, it's great that they're preparing for this one, but you know, sometimes you kind of need to look ahead as well as looking at what you've got right now, Nick.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think the biggest problem is just using rankings to determine qualification because, you know, if everyone just gets dropped back, you know, say the Super 8 qualifying teams make it to the next one and then everybody else is just dropped back into regional qualifying, I think that makes a lot more sense, really. Like in my somewhat cynical opinion, I think the main reason they're doing this rankings thing is in case one of the big teams, let's say, stuffs up in their group stage and doesn't make it through to the Super 8. And so, you know, they don't want to have, you know, let's say England has a shocker and they lose to Namibia or whoever and or Scotland, as they have done in the past. And, you know, so England don't make it through to the Super 8s, but by having the rankings determine the cutoff for the next event, that ensures that England doesn't actually have to suffer the indignity of you know, playing up against you know, Italy and Jersey in a regional qualifier. So yeah, I think that's probably what's motivating the rankings thing, but it is just a bit silly to be using rankings because ultimately it incentivizes teams to not play. And you know, good on Namibia for playing this series. It's I believe it's the remnants of there was going to be a tri-series or quad series. Uganda was supposed to be involved, and yeah, so this is kind of the remnants of that, you know, whatever that was supposed to be. And is it in their best interests to be playing this series? Probably not, based on the rankings. And you know, there's a lot of cases where, you know, we saw, obviously we talked to Corey Rutgers and he was very open about the fact that they're, you know, trying to use the rankings system to their advantage and choosing their opponents based on, you know, maximizing the potential gain for them. And you know, that's fine, but then if everyone's doing that, then you'll reach this kind of standoff when nobody actually wants to play each other. So I really think the rankings as the cutoff is just doesn't make a lot of sense, especially for a World Cup. You know, if you're talking about something like, you know, down the qualification pathways, you know, how to get into the qualification ladder. I mean, somewhere eventually you're going to probably want to use rankings. I don't know. That's a slightly different question. But for the World Cup, it makes absolutely no sense not to just have teams qualify through regional qualification. You know, I mean, you look at FIFA. We always make this comparison, but you know, Germany plays San Marino in qualification, and that happens, and you know, everyone just kind of accepts it. And yes, Germany thrashes San Marino, but then everybody moves on, and it's not a big deal. So I don't really see why we have to go through this silly system to prevent major full members from playing regional qualification. I think it would improve cricket in the region, and it would help grow the game. So yeah, I mean, the rankings stuff is a bit silly, and again, go on to Bertus's Twitter account and we'll see even more nonsense with the women's side of things, because the women's ODI teams have played so few ODIs that literally the order in which they play each other will impact the rankings to an extent that seems unfair in terms of using those rankings for qualifying for anything if they do. So yeah, qualifications based on rankings is always a bit silly, and it's not ideal to have a situation where you're incentivized not to play. But yeah, good on Namibia for still playing this rather than, you know, trying to game the system and pulling out. But ultimately, other than that, I think it's a you know, it's been a good series, and they had a good hit out.
Yeah, looking to Oman, and as you mentioned at the top, both teams got, I think, what they wanted out of this. And we know, we look at Oman, and it's been a bit of an inside joke over the last couple of years now that this is a team that by the time has caught up to at this point. You know, the golden age of Omani cricket, I think, is probably coming to an end in terms of a generational thing. But there are a couple of newer faces who have come into the setup and played international cricket. Pratik Adivale is one player who, he might not be young in some places at 26, but in the grand scheme of this Omani team, he is a spring chicken. Sameh Srivastava is another new face in this team. I think he's played fewer than 10 T20Is, but he's 33 years old, a leg spinner now with no Kawa Ali in the setup anymore, who we believe has popped up in the US somewhere. But looking at this performance and claiming two wins out of the five matches against the team above them in the rankings and ultimately doing their rankings a little bit of good, Nazim Kushi, again, out of the woodwork. He's been in and around the setup for a long time. He's over the age of 40, just like many of his other compatriots here in the Omani team. Is able to launch and go long and hit big. But looking around, they missed Akib Ilyas at the during the qualification for the 2022 T20 World Cup. That's a, you know, an amazing story. He had, you know, what at one stage they thought was a cancerous bone tumor in his leg. It turned out to be benign, and he was able to kind of go under the knife and patch up there. But they did miss him at, you know, in the last T20 World Cup campaign, not making the T20 World Cup proper and missing out through the through one of the two global qualifiers that were run in conjunction with each other. But yeah, looking at Oman, I think it's a point that we've brought up a couple of times over the past year or so. This is a team that have reached probably the end of their golden age. Zeeshan Maqsood is managed in this series, and they sort of threw the captaincy around, changed a few things at the top of the order. You would think Jitendra Singh would be the main man at the top of the order. They, you know, gave Bilal Khan a bit of a rest as well. So we didn't see, I think, all the cards that Oman have kept close to their chest in terms of this series. But again, they are looking for a couple of new faces just to inject some youth. Again, these teams meet each other in the group stage, and they face Australia, England, and Scotland. So, you know, you would think that a top two spot in this group would be close to unattainable. I can't really see a possibility of it happening or a sort of parallel universe where it happens. But again, some important matches under the belt just for a couple of new faces and just trying to put together their squad for this tournament in the USA and the Caribbean in a couple of months' time.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same problem of the, you know, the aging team, and how do you bring in new blood into this side, it is kind of a cause for concern, I guess, that so few younger players are coming through, and you know, where's the under-19s crop coming through? And yeah, so a lot of questions on that front. But I mean, well, I mean, Nassim Kushi, where did this come from? He, as you say, he's been sort of around the team for a long time and hasn't really done a whole lot from memory. But yeah, suddenly comes here and bashes 150 runs in three knocks and hits at a strike rate of 180. So yeah, good for him. If he's found that kind of form at the age of 41, more power to him. But yeah, Akib Ilyas, good contributions with bat and ball. I mean, you said no leg spinners in the setup. Akib Ilyas is still bowling leg spin, and he was tough to get away for the Namibians when he rolled the arm over here. Fayaz Butt, I think, took the most wickets for Oman. He's still charging in. Mehran Khan is another one who has kind of been sort of there or thereabouts. He's another guy who's in his mid-30s, but he was good in this series, actually, even though he hasn't necessarily set the world alight in his previous appearances. So this is kind of another team where you really don't know who their best 11 is, because yeah, there's some sort of automatic picks. I mean, you would think Bilal Khan's an automatic pick, but he bowled sort of six overs and went for 70 runs or something, so he got absolutely pumped in this series. So I don't, you know, where does that leave them? Is Zeeshan Maqsood going to be playing? I mean, he's been a great captain for them over the last little while, but does he play as a specialist captain? You know, he's not really contributing with bat or ball at the moment. So yeah, I don't know. Yeah, definitely some questions for them in terms of their 11, and where are they finding you know, the replacements for the senior players who, you know, you can't keep relying on 41-year-old Nassim Kushi or even 36 or 37-year-old Zeeshan Maqsood, or yeah, even Akib Ilyas, who's one of the younger players in this team. He's sort of 31, 32 now. So yeah, you'd think they would still put up a good fight at the T20 World Cup, but yeah, how much longer they can hold on is kind of a question.
These two teams meet in Group B of the tournament, and they actually play on match day two, the 2nd of June in Barbados. So slightly different location to the Al Amarat facility, although we know that the Al Amarat facility is excellent. I'm sure just the palm trees and the Caribbean nature will just add a little bit of spice to that T20 World Cup matchup, and a neutral venue, of course, I suppose, which will even things up a little bit too. Let's go to Nepal. Nepal with a little bit of movement here, and they've just announced as well a series with a West Indies A touring side, which is, to be honest, a brilliant get in my opinion. I think these are the series that Nepal really need to focus on sorting themselves, home series. You know, Nepal is a place that many people want to travel and play cricket. They're an excellent host, and the TU ground has stood up well in international hosting in recent weeks and months. So good to see that. They've also picked up Rodney Eswick as a bowling consultant for the T20 World Cup, who will give them invaluable experience, I think, in those conditions come the T20 World Cup. But looking to their little moves around, they had the SMS Friendship Cup with Baroda and Gujarat. They ended up taking that tournament as well. And then they've hosted Island Wolves. I suppose a bit of a Lenny connection, this. Good to get the Wolves over there. And I think a lot of lessons learned for a number of players here. A good hit out for the Nepali guys who are in the national setup and vying for spots in that T20 World Cup squad. We'll get to, I suppose, the scores in a moment and what, you know, players have potentially learned from this. But the Irish as well sent, you know, a few international players to this, and I think just a great experience for a lot of these guys to get under their belts. We know that Island cricket is not in the greatest shape at the moment, and we know that in the months of April to September, while it is their summer, they're struggling to put on domestic matches. We know that there's been issues of first-class cricket in the country amongst weather and facilities and other things, so good to get them out there to Nepal and playing in a tour like this. And again, in a similar vein to Namibia and Oman, great hit out for both teams in which they can prepare for some more serious cricket down the line.
Yeah, it was interesting to see. Well, I mean, it's kind of the development side for both these teams. The Ireland Wolves played a couple of matches against the senior Nepal 11 and got absolutely thrashed. So that's kind of an interesting little point to make that, I mean, at least at home, the Nepal I don't know if they would be favourites against the senior Ireland team, but it'll be a pretty close series, you would think. But yeah, looking on the other side of things with the Nepal A versus Ireland Wolves series, very high scoring T20 series, which, you know, we saw that a couple of months ago with the you know, the tri-series with Nepal, Netherlands and Namibia. And you know, the T20 matches were very high scoring, but the 50 over games were quite hard fought, and 220 was kind of a winnable total in the ODIs. So interesting to see the same pattern, and I think it has a lot to do with the dew that forms at TU ground. They did play all these matches at TU, which I don't know. I mean, I was a little bit, I understand because they were, you know, they were drawing crowds and, you know, they want the gate revenue, but I was also a little bit disappointed that they didn't try out some of the other venues in Nepal. And, you know, this is kind of an ongoing issue in Nepal, is where are the other cricket grounds at? But yeah, overall the series, I mean, yeah, Ireland Wolves win by 21, they win by 40, and Nepal wins by 3. All of those matches, the first team put up over 200, and in two of the three, the second team also put up over 200. So yeah, very high scoring. Some interesting names. Lokesh Bam hit a century in a losing cause in the first game, got them over 200, but they couldn't quite get over the line. He has not done a whole lot in his opportunities in the senior team. So interesting to see him hitting it well here. And I guess it bodes well for the depth. You know, we've talked about how Nepal are kind of finding this sort of rotating cast of backup players. Certainly on the batting side, they do have a lot of depth. Arif Sheikh hit 90-odd, didn't quite get the ton, but it was in a winning cause in that third T20. So yeah, a lot of names that we've seen before, but are sort of on the fringes of the national team. Impressive effort from Nepal there, and the Ireland Wolves, I guess, doing enough. You know, PJ Moore that's an interesting name to see coming back for the Ireland Wolves, because you know you'd kind of think at his age, you know, is he really in their future plans? So I guess that's sort of a question. But yeah, I mean, Neil Rock, Gareth Delaney, Stephen Doherty is another one who made an appearance there. So, you know, guys that we've sort of seen before, but yeah, on the fringes of the national team, playing pretty well. Not a whole lot to write home about in the T20 series from a bowling perspective, because you know, everyone was kind of getting pumped. But yeah, looking across to the 50 over series, the first match was pretty close. Ireland Wolves bowled out for 157, thanks to Kamal Singhairi bowling very well with a 4-wicket haul. But then, yeah, Nepal collapsed for 136. And the next two games were very heavily one-sided for Ireland. 174 on the board in the second game, and Nepal bowled out for 60. Matthew Humphreys somehow took 6 for 8. I mean, you wouldn't expect him to be the destroying bowler, but he took a 5-wicket haul in the first match and then 6 for 8 in the second. So I don't know what's got into his Weet-Bix, but it seems to be bowling very well against the team that you would expect to be able to handle, you know, his kind of, I don't know, I just haven't seen him do a whole lot with the ball in his appearances for the senior Ireland team. And yes, it's a slightly less experienced Nepal side here, but you know, he's sort of struck me as just sort of pretty bog standard left arm orthodox, and that's the kind of stuff that Nepal, they should be able to face that based on, you know, the amount of left arm spinners that are floating around in Nepal. So not sure what was going on there, but you know, good for Humphreys. Yeah, and then the last match, the Ireland Wolves put up 284, Stephen Doherty with a ton, and Nepal bowled out for 215. Arjun Kamal hit a ton as well, but other than that, they struggled. So, yeah, I mean, a good hit out for both teams. It is interesting to see that Nepal's, I guess, second 11 or development team is on a pretty similar standard to Ireland's development team. So that's encouraging signs for Nepal's depth. But the only question I would have here is, you know, again, this is something we keep going back to. Where are their fast bowlers coming from? Because they really haven't been able to produce anyone who's able to create much cut through with the new ball. They have a lot of good spinners coming through on the Nepali side, but yeah, not a lot of seam options.
The point you make about the two teams being on a relatively equal standing, I think bodes well for Nepal, you know, to take on a full Members A team and really push them. I know they're at home. It's good to see a couple of new faces and names that we haven't really had a chance to look too much at from a Nepal A standpoint, and you know, with a little bit of a lack of domestic cricket going on in this particular point in time. But yeah, they did well to go around and to win two of those T20Is. I looked at the one day matches at times and thought that they probably could have given a little bit more with the bat, you know, rolling over and being bowled out for 60, I think is to Matthew Humphries as well, who was a gun in under 19 cricket and he's slowly finding his way in senior cricket. To see him take 6 for 8 is a little bit surprising against a team of Nepal's experience against spin, as you pointed out too. But you know, you look at that scorecard and you're just kind of hoping for someone like a Bim Sharkey to step up. And Binod Bhandari, who's been in the setup for a long time now. And Bim, you know, you get to 17 off 20 balls and you then throw it away when you're probably seeing it better than any of your teammates. That is something that you really want to iron out. But in saying that, you know, this is a team that's probably looking at concentrating on the shorter of the two white ball formats. So I'm not too sure what to take out of all of that. And it is a good hit out. I mean, if you are to learn your lessons now and iron the creases out now, you go to the USA and the West Indies for a number of these guys who will put their hand up in terms of T20 World Cup selection. But, you know, just looking at this group and let's just take sort of the T20 group here as kind of the yardstick of where players need to be, actually for both sides. But looking at this probably more from a Nepali standpoint, you know, guys like Gareth Delaney have come. You know, he was one of the nailed on first players named on an island T20I team sheet going back 3 or 4 years and is now, you know, finding it hard to actually make the first team. But just to look at this, maybe Nepali teams to kind of bring up the example, you look at the names on this list and you say to yourself, you know, who out of these players are going to be in the conversation for, you know, being picked up in the squad? Dev Kanal's been really disappointing across the 19s and through this series as well, both, you know, bowling and batting. He's left a little bit to be desired. He was economical at times with the ball when he got the chance to bowl, but didn't really make inroads in terms of wickets taken and struggled a little bit with the bat. So I dare say he's going to struggle to make that T20 World Cup squad. You know, the Binod Bhandaris of the world, Kamal Singh Iree is another player, Dakal. These are all players that are kind of, you know, waiting in the wings, looking for their chance. And, you know, ultimately, I don't think they've really done enough. I don't think that, you know, anyone who was kind of on the periphery of this Nepali team have really done anything to say that they've been unfortunate to kind of miss out in senior squads in the past. And to be honest, I can't really see I think I can see that Nepali T20 World Cup squad is pretty much ready to go now after this series that's been recently completed.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of guys, you sort of think maybe it's worth having another look at them. Lokesh Bam, yeah, like I said, I mean, he hasn't done much in his opportunities, but, you know, if you score a ton in 50 balls, it's probably worth having another look at the guy. And yeah, none of the bowlers, though, really impressed enough to be worth persisting with, I think. But, you know, they still have that West Indies A team, which is going to be an interesting barometer for both sides, both in terms of, you know, West Indies' depth ahead of the World Cup and Nepal. Yeah, are they'll probably play their senior team or something approaching it. So that'll be an interesting series and probably quite entertaining, especially in home conditions for Nepal. But then, you know, do you put in a Bam or even a Bim Sharkey, give him another go, or an Arif Sheikh to see if he can perform against slightly better opposition? Although, you know, is the West Indies A team really even that much better than the Island Wolves? That's another question I would have. It's a good get in terms of box office, but in terms of quality, I guess we'll find out. But I think that series is going to be probably quite decisive in terms of, you know, where Nepal are thinking their final sort of squad of 15 or so is going to be. But yeah, I mean, that starts at the end of the month in April. So a little bit of time to kind of mull over the results here. But yeah, very interested in how that ends up happening. And as we say, like this whole series with Ireland Wolves and Nepal, I mean, Nepal have been on a bit of a roll recently, haven't they? They've had quite a lot of good series at home. They've got some good opposition over. They're organising cricket. They're running a lot of stuff to get the senior team in form for the World Cup, and it seems, hopefully it's paying off. And yeah, I mean, just quickly looking across at that SMS Friendship Cup, that was called the Tri-Series, between Indian state teams, and you know, Nepal winning the final in that is encouraging as well. So you look at Nepal and you think they're a pretty strong chance, especially in that very open Group D, you know, South Africa, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Netherlands, Nepal. You'd kind of imagine South Africa is a bridge too far, but, you know, there's not really any reason why they can't beat any of those other teams. And, you know, I think if, on a good day, Nepal could. So they look pretty strong coming into the World Cup, and this level of prep. I mean, often the level of prep that a team has does pretty much make all the difference in terms of how they perform at the main event. So the fact that they're putting on so much cricket definitely bodes well.
And not to mention too, and just quickly, we'll talk about this probably more next week when it starts, but the ACC Premier Cup begins on April 12. Nepal are in that competition as well. They're in Group A with Hong Kong, Malaysia, Qatar, and the qualifier, or one of the two qualifiers, Saudi Arabia. Cambodia with the other qualifier, they take part in Group B alongside Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, and UAE. There's just one spot in that competition for the 2025 Asia Cup. We'll talk about that competition more once it does begin, probably next week. But yeah, looking at that tournament, that's another good hit out for the Nepal senior team, and just, you know, eyeballing that squad, none of them are having to make a quick dash from the TU ground to that one. So, you know, you're seeing upwards of, say, 25 Nepali cricketers getting a run before the T20 World Cup, you know, across the Island Wolves Tour and the ACC Premier Cup. So plenty of action for a lot of guys trying to put their hand up. And I don't envy Monty Desai having to watch all of that cricket at once and trying to put together his squad. Good luck to him and his one-ball battles, his mantra that he likes to use in Nepali international cricket. We'll talk about the ACC Premier Cup a little bit more next week, but I suppose the other big news story that's come out of the squads of this tournament is that Viridi Aravind is not being picked by UAE. Now, we understand he's in the UK and playing cricket there, but he also studies, I think, at Loughborough, which might have made it a little bit difficult for him to get out and play in this tournament. But even with him sort of not picked there, it, you know, adds a little bit of mystery. And we did see the backflip of Usman Khan being picked up being called up by Pakistan instead of hanging around with UAE, in a pretty unprecedented statement by the UAE and their disappointment of him being let go, and they've cut all ties with him for the time being. We'll probably talk a little bit more about all of that next week when we do get the details a little bit more about all of that. I know Paul Radley's been on the case over at the National in UAE trying to get to the bottom of that story. So, and some more cricket that's going on. USA hosting Canada in a five-match T20I series as preparation for the T20 World Cup. USA have taken an early 2-0 lead, as we do recall, but we'll talk about that next week as well. So, again, the to-do list here at Emerging Cricket, never-ending, Nick. Thank you for joining me. For more, log on to emergingcricket.com. Wherever you are around the world, trying to keep up with the news and events from the game's new world, as well as wherever you are listening to the podcast, make sure you do give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the pod. That does help a lot. And to our patrons, a huge thank you for your patronage. And if you'd like to become a Patreon subscriber, log on to patreon.com/emergingcricket. But Nick, any final thoughts before we head into another week of emerging cricket watching and analysis and dissection?
No, nothing really to add. Just very excited to watch Canada keep playing, even though they've lost the first two matches of the series, but we can talk about that later.
Your boy Nicholas Curtin coming up and scoring bulk runs and a good strike rate as well. But we'll talk about that next week, hopefully with a few more runs under his belt as well. Thank you for joining us, everyone, on this week's Emerging Cricket Podcast. But for now, on behalf of Nick Skinner and myself, Daniel Beswick, it is goodbye.